Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hola. You're listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm coming at you from Venice, Mexico. Name's Lady P. No relation to Master P. And today's guest has come sporting his leather jacket. It's Professor James Naramore. Welcome back, Jim.
I'm happy to be back. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Listeners will recall that Professor Naramore has joined me on previous episodes for Mulholland Drive and Rear Window and the North by Northwest episode. And Jim, if I'm not mistaken, I do believe that one of your previous FlixWise appearances had us discussing Janet Leigh trapped in a rundown motel room.
Yes. In fact, I suspect Hitchcock probably saw the movie we're going to talk about right now.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Wells thought so, anyway.
Well, yeah. We can. I think there's probably good evidence to suggest that that's the case. But today we are returning to similarly CD territory. This time, poor Janet's getting leered at, not by Anthony Perkins, but by Dennis Weaver in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil. We've got to stop meeting like this, Jim. actually, the reason I asked you on for this episode and why I'm so glad you're here is because you wrote a book on Welles called The Magic World of Orson Welles, and I'm hoping you can fill us in on some of the details of the labyrinthian plot and tell us why this film ended up as the 57th movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, or at least give us your best guess.
Yeah, I'll try.
Yeah. And for our second topic, we're sticking with Orson. This round, we're discussing his infamous Harry Lime character from Carol Reed's film The Third Man, specifically the speech that was apparently written by Welles himself about how wars and strife foster more significant cultural products than peace and brotherly love. So is he right? Do hard times really make for great art? We shall discuss. Finally, we're going to celebrate some great art that we've enjoyed recently with some final notes of positivity. All right, Jim, shall we get to it?
Sure, let's go.
Hey, what's that ticking sound? Our first topic of the day is the 56th movie on the Sight and Sound list, Orson Welles' 1958 noir classic, Touch of Evil, which means I now have the unenviable task of summing up the plot. Like lots of crime thrillers of the era, the story in Touch of Evil meanders so as to mount tension and keep the viewer purposefully confused. The central police case that kicks off the action becomes essentially a red herring. It involves a car bomb going off on the American side of a U.S.-Mexico border town, killing a prominent local businessman. With the death occurring on U.S. soil, the case falls under American jurisdiction, which means American police detective Hank Quinlan is on the job. Quinlan, played by Orson Welles, is a walking grotesquerie. He's morbidly obese, unshaven, unkempt, and a steady stream of racial epithets and open hostility come constantly slurring out of his mouth. But of course he's a hero in his department, and local law enforcement officials have every confidence he'll figure out who done it. There is, however, a small wrinkle that threatens to derail Quinlan's efforts. That wrinkle's name is Miguel Vargas, a Mexican narcotics officer played by Charlton Heston. Vargas witnesses the explosion while on honeymoon with his American wife, Susie, played by Janet Leigh, and decides to tag along on Quinlan's investigations. The film then introduces lots of new plot developments and characters, including a grudge match between a local gang called the Grandes, who kidnap Susie. Mercedes McCambridge shows up, a.k.a. Emma Smalls, decked out in a leather jacket and a greaser haircut, and starts torturing poor Susie. But the primary conflict of the film is between Quinlan and Vargas and their opposing approaches to policing. Quinlan runs on pure intuition, which is a nice way of saying first he figures out who's guilty and then looks for evidence. And if he can't find that evidence, well, somehow it always magically appears. Vargas, however, believes in doing things by the book. You know, due process, innocent before proven guilty, etc. And he makes it his personal mission to put a stop to Quinlan's corrupt methods. At the time of its release, Touch of Evil was considered a cheap B-movie and was never given a proper theatrical booking. Like so many of Welles' Hollywood movies, it was recut by the studio upon initial release. Fortunately, in this case, Welles made extensive notes about how he wanted the film to look and sound, and years later, Walter Murch was able to restore Welles' vision with a new edition of the film. But is this revision worthy of the 57th spot on the Sight and Sound Critics poll? We shall discuss. All right. Jim, do you like Touch of Evil?
I wouldn't be here otherwise.
Yeah. I don't know many people who don't like Touch of Evil. It's really fun. Not only is it great and interesting, it's really fun.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I think it's become probably Wells's easiest movie to sell to people.
Yeah. I think this is the film of his that I introduce to people if they want to get into Wells. I don't recommend starting off with Kane. It doesn't necessarily mean that this will end up being their favorite. Sort of people's mileage may vary, but I don't know. This seems the most. I guess it's the most fun, the most straightforward. It's the most familiar, the noir story. You know,
right? It's one of my top four.
Yeah. So when did you first see it?
I actually saw it when it was originally released. I am that old. 1958.
Nice.
And I saw it in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And it made I saw it in the movie theater. It made a really strong impression on me. 58 was like 4 years after the civil rights movement began, after the, you know, incidents in Little Rock when they tried to integrate the schools there. And for me, the movie had the quality of the simmering racial violence underlying the South. And I liked it for that reason. But I was also, you know, just dazzled by it otherwise. I was already a fan of Wells. So,
gotcha. Anyway. And you saw the original cut then?
Yeah, I saw the original release version, which is the shortest of the three versions that we have.
Yeah. So what are the three versions?
Well, there's a there's the version I'm talking about that I saw when I was a kid, and then there's a discovered preview version that's a little bit longer. I think it was discovered at UCLA, I think, if I remember correctly. And that one is a little bit longer. It contains some additional material, but it also contains, I think, more material shot by a Universal House director named Harry Keller, who did a few shots to, you know, make plot points clearer. But it also has other material that was not in the original cut. And then there's the Walter Murch version that you're talking about, which is based on this very long 50 or more page memo that Wells wrote to Universal about trying to defend the film against certain things they were doing and indicating things he wanted them to do. And so that's the long version, the so-called definitive version. But it's not definitive because there is no definitive version. Wells was never allowed a final cut of the film. But it probably is closer to Wells's intention. Paradoxically, it's not my favorite of the three versions. That's
What's
right.
What's your favorite?
Well, I like Jonathan Rosenbaum, and I did a commentary for the film, and we chose to do the second version, the preview version, which I think is my favorite of the three.
Okay.
I feel like Universal's meddling with the film didn't damage it as much as other studios meddling with Wells' work did. It probably survives the tampering better than some of the others, like Amberson's, for example.
Right.
I've always been very fond of the Henry Mancini score. What the original version and the preview version do, they have the credits pasted over this very long, elaborate take that begins the 2.5 minute or so take that begins the opening of the film. And they have Henry Mancini's music, and the shot involves you see a guy rushing down the street and planting a time bomb in the back of a car. And the camera then arches up over a roof and follows the car as it comes down the streets of this border town, ultimately crossing the border, and then the bomb explodes on the American side. And the main characters are introduced in this shot, or Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh anyway. So A, the credits are pasted over it, and you have Henry Mancini's music playing. Mm-hmm. It's a non-diegetic score. Wells had wanted, and this is very typical of Wells, and I'm sure it would have been great if Wells had done it. Two or three times in his career, he tried to do this, and he never really had an opportunity to do it. The idea being a long tracking shot in which the camera passes different people in different storefronts or whatever, and you get a kind of montage of sounds feeding out in the shot. Mm-hmm. He wanted something like that in the original, his script for Heart of Darkness. He tried to do something like that in The Lady from Shanghai, and he wanted to do it again here, and I'm sure it would have been great. But it's not Wells doing it. It's Walter Murch doing it, and he's a fine fellow and all that. But you really need Wells's genius with the soundtrack. And later in the film, there's a wonderful example of that at the climax of the film, where you get cutting back and forth between Charlton Heston with a radio following Quinlan having a conversation, and the way the film cuts back and forth between those levels of sound is fascinating. And I'm sure this would have been good, but I don't like the Murch recreation. It feels artificial to me.
Okay.
And as I say, I'm very fond of the Henry Mancini music. So there's something about the, the kind of tawdry studio opening that works for me, so that's why I like a second version.
Fair enough. Well, let's go back to your first point about how this is the story of the two opposing police officers and their different approaches to policing can kind of serve as a metaphor for the civil rights movement. That's really interesting. So I sort of gave a basic overview of what their differing worldviews are and their differing approaches, but let's delve into that further. So Quinlan, Quinlan sort of represents the kind of bitter sort of his sort of become corrupt. Do you think it was his policing that got him, that forced him to become corrupt? I mean, it's sort of the film lays out this backstory where his wife was murdered by
what he calls a half-breed.
Half-breed, yeah. Right, yeah. And do you buy that that's his origin story and that's the source of his kind of bitterness? Or is it just, yeah?
Yeah. I think the film, it throws out that possibility. But as Wells once said about Rosebud, as Dollar Book Freud, yeah. I think, you know, he's already culturally predisposed to be a racist, and I think he lives in a kind of sour loneliness, almost a Xanadu-like isolation in this turkey ranch somewhere in the south of Texas, and he's the sort of king of the local law enforcement. What I think is distinctive about the film is that the political message of the film is it's Wells's message, and it's very clear. That, as Wells said, the policeman's job to enforce the law, not to make the law.
Right.
And there's a speech that Charlton Heston has at one point in the film. policing is only easy in a police state.
Right.
but Quinlan is a complicated and rich, interesting character. So your interest is pulled toward him, and this is quite typical of Wells. It dates, I think, all the way back to the Modern Dress Julius Caesar that he did in the anti-fascist Julius Caesar that he did in the 30s, where he said he didn't like plays that had left-wing plays that had sort of cardboard Simon Legree villains. So the rhetorical emphasis, the political emphasis of the film is one thing, but the emotional inflections of the film are more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
So Mike Vargas, the Charlton Heston character, who's the exemplar of rightness and the right kind of political attitudes, is a kind of a stiff guy, and he becomes a little more gray as the film goes along. Whereas there's a certain pathos or an interest about about Quinlan, even though he's wrong, even though he's evil in many ways.
Right.
But he's a humane character. I don't know how to state this adequately.
Right.
But it's that tension. So a lot of people expect political movies to be really straightforward, so that like a film that came out almost about the same time as this was 12 Angry Men, where a Latino is accused of a crime wrongly, and the, you know, kind of a racist is on the jury, and Henry Fonda stands up nobly and does all the right things. So there's never any question that Henry Fonda is the right guy in this movie.
Right.
And all of our emotional sympathies are with him. That's the kind of simple, usual kind of left-wing way of doing these movies, but that wasn't Welles' way of doing it.
Right. Yeah, he sort of undercuts his own philosophy by putting his words in the mouth of this kind of ninny. Do you think that character, that Mike Vargas character, would play differently if it weren't Charlton Heston?
I think that any character probably in any movie would be different if a different actor played them.
Well, yeah, but the specific persona of Heston.
Right. Yeah. I think Heston. I may be in the minority here. I don't know, but I think Heston is really good in the movie. One of the reasons why he's good, he occupies the kind of position that, say, Joseph Cotten used to do in relation to Welles, like Joseph Cotten and Welles in The Third Man. Harry Lime is the villainous character, and Cotten is the good guy. Or in Citizen Kane, you know, Jed Leland, the Cotten character, is the kind of liberal, and Kane is the potential tyrant. But what makes this one a little bit different is that Heston is as equally powerful a figure as Welles. So, and several times in the films, they stand and face off against one another. And Heston also has a certain Shakespearean grandeur as an actor. And so he can stand up to Welles that way, also. The film has been, you know, criticized as being politically incorrect because, Heston goes around in this brown makeup all the time in the film. But I think he's very persuasive as a Mexican. And I like him in the role. I think he does a good job in it.
Right, yeah. I mean, it wouldn't play today, but I think he is well-suited to the role.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I think it's probably... I guess what is the intent of the makeup, right? It's not to make him undignified. In fact, he's probably the most dignified character in the whole movie.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Welles as an actor. We so often talk about him as director, and then we forget that he's also the star of these movies. And I mean, you've written a book not only on Welles, but on screen acting. What do you make of Welles as an actor?
I think he's a wonderful actor. I mean, good grief, he's a terrific actor.
Yeah.
I think he has limits as an actor, like all actors do. I think physically, he's relatively. It's not that he's immobile, but he doesn't have all the skills that an actor would have in movement. Some actors are interesting to watch just walking across a room. Welles doesn't usually figure that way. In fact, you can use Touch of Evil as an example, because an awful lot of the shots in Touch of Evil involving Charlton Heston, the Mike Vargas character, are wide-angle tracking shots where he's walking sort of powerfully forward and the camera's tracking back and following him. So the wide angle makes the space kind of dynamic as he moves forward, whereas the shots involving Vargas are usually stationary, the shots involving Quinlan are usually stationary, and I think that's so that Welles is working around his usual actor qualities. He does have the great physical power that he can use. The murder of Joe Grandy in the film, one of the many spectacular moments in the film, involves Welles, the sense of his physical power, you know, picking up a man, shoving him across the room, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he can be a frightening, strong character. But I don't think he doesn't have the leading man's agility. The closest film he comes to in that sort of thing is Black Magic, that Gregory Ratoff movie where he plays Cagliostro, which was made in the 1940s. It's a costume picture, campy costume picture. But he's pretty good in that.
Yeah.
But there's even a dueling scene in it that he does. But I wouldn't put him up against Basil Rathbone.
Yeah, probably not. Yeah, I think, yeah, as you say, he uses his size to his advantage. He imposes on the frame.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and as far as the other performances in the movie, I want to talk about Marlena Dietrich, who I didn't mention in the intro. But oh,
no,
my God.
Should.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, in fact, the movie wouldn't work without Marlena Dietrich. I don't know quite how to explain that, but I think anyone who's seen the movie would agree. In a way, it's preposterous. She plays this aging Mexican prostitute who speaks with a German accent. it's Marlena Dietrich, you know, with black hair and all this heavy makeup and everything. But boy, when she says, "Your future is all used up."
Yep.
She's so good at that. It's like those songs she used to sing in the Sternberg movies where she's virtually speaking the lyrics of a song. And at the end of the movie where she says adios, I just melt when she says that.
I
realize I am gushing like a foolish fan, but I there's some kind of something that he's dropped into the movie. You know, she's an old pal of his. Most of his old friends are in that movie. Yikes.
Yeah, no, she, as you say, it's hard to kind of put your finger on what exactly she brings to the movie. Because it's already, the movie has plenty of gravitas. You know, Wells... Well, is,
no, she brings a sort of sentiment and and she represents a kind of earth motherliness,
right.
and Quinlan's own regressive adolescence or something like that. I don't know.
Right.
And she's a cliched figure, you know, the earth motherly prostitute, you know.
Right.
But wow, she gets away with it.
Really does. Yeah. I mean. I think in your book, if I'm remembering correctly, don't you say that she's kind of the Rosebud character of this film?
Yeah. I think, yeah, there's a point where Quinlan is going into Tana's bordello, and I think it's Ray Collins in the background says, she's going to bring out the crystal ball for him or mm-hmm. something like that. He says, it's almost like a reference to Kane's sentimental childhood, you know.
Right, and it's sort of it reminds me of the Devil is a Woman. Is that the movie?
Yeah.
I think that was the last movie she made with Sternberg. But just with the Spanish, non-Spanish.
Yeah, right. I forgot about that. She was also Spanish in that movie.
Yeah. I don't know. She gets away with it. I don't know. It's just that essence of Marlena.
There's something about Dietrich that for me is always fascinating in that she's incredibly artificial. There's almost no movie she's in that she's you don't believe this character,
right.
But she's fascinating. Yeah.
Right. Anyway. Yeah. The world always builds around her in a movie, right? So in this movie, like there's this whole separate plot and story going on, but every time she's on screen, it seems to stop. It all just seems to melt away.
It's
amazing.
True. And it's self-referential in too, because Wells and Dietrich were friends, and I guess in the people who would have an earlier memory of him, he in his magic act, he used to saw her in half. And
And I guess we should contrast her role with the Janet Leigh's role.
Again, it's a kind of a cliched pairing because it's this fair lady, dark lady opposition, and it that runs all the way through Hollywood. If you think about a movie like, let's say Ford's My Darling Clementine, where you have Linda Darnell playing this woman of ill repute in the film, likable woman of ill repute. Mm-hmm. And then she's opposed to Clementine. I can't remember the woman who plays Clementine. Mm-hmm. But the good girl is fair and the naughty girl is dark.
Right.
Or sometimes they reverse that opposition. But it, you know, it's just it's so deep in American culture, and it has something to do with American fears about primitivism or wildness, and you know, sex versus motherhood, or I don't know what you would call it.
Yeah, virginity.
Yeah, and in this movie, that opposition gets all mixed up in strange ways.
Right. Yeah.
Ways. Yeah. Yeah, and Janet Leigh is just, Janet Leigh's totally believable, I think, as the sort of spunky, if naive, Philadelphia-born wife,
right.
Who I think was Manny Farber says she marries a Mexican and all of her dreams come true. Anyway,
I never know quite what to make of what happens to her character and her arc, because after. She is kidnapped and presumably raped. I guess they write that off at the end and make sure to say no harm has come to her.
Right,
yeah,
right. Now, the censorship code had to demand that they said that. But that's one of the most powerful rape scenes I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah.
It is a really scary scene, the way it works. You know, Mercedes McCambridge saying, I want to watch.
Yeah.
And they're pinning her down, spreading her legs, and a door slams.
Right.
And then another door opens in the Hall of Justice somewhere. Right. But that scene still, I think, carries a jolt. It has a punch.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you.
And then afterwards she wakes up. Oh, of course, she wasn't really raped.
Right.
She just thinks so.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah. But I think we can disregard that, I think. Any sort of position like that from the censorship bureau,
I think
we can probably ignore. I sort of feel like it's a shame that she never gets another scene where she's conscious or fully conscious. Or
well, that's
coherent.
True. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. It's Susie becomes... that's interesting. Never thought about that. But she's, what is it? She's an instrument needed in the plot.
Right.
But is cast aside then, and somehow Dietrich dominates the end of the film.
Right. Maybe there's this sort of inevitability. Like after this experience, she'll become the wizened. Dead
yes,
mother
yes,
type.
Yes, of
right?
course. And they'll all drive off to Mexico City or Philadelphia or wherever and live happily ever after.
Right, of course, yeah. Let's talk about the style of the movie. This is Welles's final Hollywood film. He never had a chance to make another film within the Hollywood studio system. And we all know, obviously, his first feature was Citizen Kane, the greatest of them all. But I wonder how he progressed as a director and how his style evolved after taking time away from Hollywood, and just maybe a comparison between the baroque, elaborate production design of Citizen Kane versus this sort of gritty noir story, and how they kind of how that his style translates onto this genre.
Right. I think what to say. Citizen Kane is a very remarkably well thought out and smart movie stylistically. And it had and Welles is one of those directors who became known for a certain style largely associated with the long take and the wide angle lens and tremendous depth of field, but this movie is more technically complex than even Citizen Kane is, and more dynamic in terms of the way the camera is used. This may have something to do with the difference in technology in the intervening years. It's been 17 years since Citizen Kane. And the available studio technology he had at hand in touch of, obviously he had Greg Toland for Citizen Kane, and Toland's style is not usually associated with the moving camera. but rather with the depth of field, which Wells exaggerates. Wells's use of Toland becomes distinctively Wellsian, I think. The photographer in Touch of Evil was Russell Meddy, who also worked on, I think he worked on The Stranger. And Meddy was one of the most important photographers of with crane shots, and that's why there's some remarkable ones in Touch of Evil. The opening shot is a crane shot, and trying to think of a couple of others where the crane is used quite inventively. That, and I think the very complex sound editing that would have been possible in Wells's version of the film. It's not a different style from Citizen Kane, but it's, I think, more various and complex. And whereas Kane went sort of mechanically back and forth between sequences that involve long takes and sort of what they call lightning montages at the time, you know, like the election is covered in a few shots or the marriage is covered in a few shots. Citizen Kane had to do with sort of then versus now. Whereas this is more like here versus there, and it's also more like the big crane shot at the beginning of the movie ends with a kiss between this white woman and this Mexican man, or this Anglo woman and Mexican man, and the kiss happens at the moment when the car explodes, so it's as if the kiss has set off the violence almost. Mm-hmm. And when the car explodes, you go from the long take to this incredible montage of chaos, people running through the streets and so forth. And people forget that Wells was as good at that sort of thing as he was with the long take. Anyway,
right.
I'm rambling, but I wouldn't say it's any radically new style for Wells, but it's it's a little more bravura in certain ways.
Right. Yeah, in case you needed more.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, I think it's remarkable how he continued to evolve and adopt new styles and adopt new technologies.
Well, part of the issue was, if, of course, essentially slightly before Kane and then afterward, he was doing most of his work in Europe and was an independent director. And with Othello, for example, he had to shoot the film over years, right. Taking time out to act in a movie or something and trying to remember what the previous shot was when he came back to it. And so that film, though it has some long takes in it, is much more of an edited film than his others. So it depends on the production circumstances.
Right.
But he is a you know, all the skills that go into the mise-en-scene, into putting images together, into creating fascinating images, he's really good at it.
Mm-hmm.
Truffaut once said of him that, and I think this is a really good point, that Wells shoots like an exhibitionist and edits like a censor. There's a sense that these incredible images appear on the screen, but they go away real fast. You can't, you keep wanting to see a little more of them.
Mm.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I just want to talk briefly about the final line of the movie, Marlena's,
yeah.
Just before adios.
Yeah.
And she says he was some kind of a man, talking about Quinlan, and then,
yeah.
And then again, shortly after, what does it matter what you say about a man? Or what does it matter what you say about people? What do you think that means?
It don't mean
quickly.
Anything to me.
Yeah,
I don't
it does
know.
Nothing.
Yeah. It sounds like one of the biggest cliches in the world. Yeah. I don't know. No, Quinlan is a guy who has a lot to be guilty about, mm-hmm. and who winds up killing his best friend or using his best friend,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of at the end of the film, the lawyer says to. Or what's his name? Mort Mills says to Charlton Heston, it turns out that what's his name was guilty after all.
Right.
But no. In the preview print of the film, the one that I was talking about, the central one, in the background of a conversation at one point over the telephone with Quinlan, you can hear the cops beating Sanchez. Mm. And Quinlan's last order is to break Sanchez. So, most people sort of take this as the great irony, you know, the bad cop was actually right. I don't think so. I think there's another layer of things going on there. So I think the film's judgment about ethical, moral judgment about Quinlan is right. It's just that he's a complex character.
Right.
And he has all these other qualities that that make him a fascinating character.
Right.
But what do you say? It doesn't matter what you say about him. And I think when I wrote my book, I mentioned that this is very similar to the lines at the end of Raymond Chandler's The Big Sleep. It's just, what does it matter when you're dead, you're sleeping the big sleep?
Right.
And does it matter if you're in a high tower or in a sumpy oil field? And in fact, Quinlan dies in a sumpty oil field.
He does. So,
Yeah.
It's interesting. I think of him as being this kind of Ethan Hunt kind of character, in that his methods may be effective. They may or may not be effective, but the ending of the film kind of suggests that his methods have fallen out of style, and that he will be forgotten eventually, you know, as Marlena disappears. Yeah. Like that's all that's left of him, you know?
Yeah. There is a certain kind of pathos about the character. And as usual with Wells' sympathies are always with the past in some way, but not in the ethical, political sense.
Right. Okay. So final question. It's the 57th movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Do you think it's worthy of 57? And I guess
it's worthy of the top 10 if you want.
I mean, absolutely. There you go.
In fact, it was a flip of the coin for me whether to put that on or some other. Yeah. In fact, I voted for it as
you
one
did.
Of
okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. There you go. So then it should be higher for sure.
Yeah.
Well, what the fella said, in Italy for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock. So long, Holly.
That clip you just heard was the infamous cuckoo clock speech delivered by Harry Lime to his friend Holly Martins in the 1949 international thriller The Third Man. In it, Lime justifies his abhorrent actions by claiming that hardships are good for humanity, and that they offer prime material for artists, and they ultimately foster creative growth. The speech is the best remembered part of the film, and Lime almost makes you believe it's true. Why am I bringing up this topic now? Well, one obvious reason is that I had Wells bumping around in my head last week because of Touch of Evil. But perhaps more significantly, by the time this episode is released, Donald Trump will have recently been installed as President of the United States. I can't speak for all of our listeners, but I know I and a lot of my friends are bracing ourselves for the worst. Though I've heard a few folks on the internet suggest that the silver lining in all of this is that there's going to be so much great art coming out of this era. I have thoughts on this matter, but I want to put it to Professor Naremore first. Jim, do you buy into Lime's argument that turmoil fosters creativity?
No, I don't. I think it's complete sophistry, a charming sophistry.
Yeah.
It's just like what Harry Lime would say, right, to justify himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it leaves poor Joseph Cotton open-mouthed and with nothing to say at the end.
It's true.
But In talking about the Borgias, I think he's talking less about political turmoil than just political evil, and which applies to today. No kidding. Yeah. But there isn't any necessary connection between peace and war and art. An awful lot of great art has nothing to do with any of those things. In fact, you could almost say that in times of political turmoil, you have a lot of committed art. You have a lot of angry art. You have art that's making important political statements, but that doesn't make it good or bad art.
Right, exactly.
So anyway, I hope we will have some powerful protest voices of all kinds And I don't see, someone once said to me the other day that the only difference between Trump and Hitler is that Hitler liked art of a sort. Anyway, I don't expect Donald Trump to create a, you know, the Borgias were patrons of great art.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
They did have that on their side. So,
right.
But otherwise, no. Uh-uh.
Right. Yeah. I think that is the key distinction that is important to make here is that we're talking about people who appreciated art.
So,
and I think the key to making great art is having the resources to make the art. And so I thought just as kind of a, maybe we can sort of encourage listeners to rethink their position on government financing of the arts by talking about Wells.
It's okay with me if the government finances art. Yeah. I don't mean.
I think it's important. And
but I don't think the Trump government is going to do that.
Absolutely
or if they
not.
Did, I would be appalled at what they would.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Yeah.
They would,
no.
They would probably, you know, have a new season of Duck Dynasty and give it an Emmy or something. I don't know.
Unless you count The Apprentice as a work of art, no dice. I think we're in for kind of a hard time, honestly. I don't think there is a silver lining.
I think art is the least thing we have to worry about.
Exactly.
But,
I'd really like to see that whole sentiment disappear. And it'll be interesting to rewatch The Third Man after this experience, because I think as a kid watching that movie or a teenager watching that movie, that sentiment totally blew me away. It was like, I think you're meant to be really taken with Harry Lime.
Oh yeah.
You
sure.
Know?
Yeah.
And now as an adult,
no, he's the devil.
He's evil.
And the devil is very charming.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. We actually did an episode where we talked about most sympathetic villains. And the person that I was recording with picked Harry Lime, and I picked Quinlan. And we hadn't discussed it further. There was no mandate to have all of Wells' characters on our list.
Yeah, yeah.
But somehow
I don't think I wouldn't describe Harry Lime as sympathetic.
I don't think so either.
I would describe him as the most he steals the movie. I mean, he's the most satanically interesting and charming fellow in the movie.
Absolutely.
But that's how he gets his way.
Right, exactly. He's evil, and that sentiment is evil. And it's interesting how he uses arts to justify his wrongdoing.
Well, it's the same way he manipulates his girlfriend.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But so I think that's just something to keep in mind as we see these memes spread across the internet. I've also, in relation to film, you know, the 1970s was one of the most tumultuous times in American history, and it produced a lot of great art. And I guess that's sort of the correlation that people make when making this argument, like the best time for art was the 1970s.
I think you could argue that the 1920s was a better period for art, and that was Calvin Coolidge was president,
right?
And the 1930s, when FDR becomes president, I think it is less interesting artistically because it's mostly political art.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. Well, I mean, there were some great movies coming out of the 1930s, though.
Oh, yeah. No. I'm thinking about literature.
Like fine arts. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, whatever.
Fair, yeah. That's interesting.
No, but no. The popular art of the movies was great in the 30s.
Right, right.
But James Joyce, Franz Kafka, even in the U.S., Hemingway and Fitzgerald, those people, their best work is all in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the optimistic note to end this segment on is that there is great art in every era, and hopefully this era will pass, and we will continue. We will have great art in this era and in the next. And I think that there's also something to be said about, you know, the nature of the art will change, and that maybe there'll be more of an appetite for angry art. And it tends, the 1970s was like, as far as movies goes, it basically excluded women, not just women directors, but women characters.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I'm hesitant to hold that era up as like, as the pinnacle of movie making.
Yeah, I never do that. I don't know who does, but maybe there are people out there who do that. I think that's that wouldn't get my vote.
Yeah. Hear, hear. Okay. All right. Well, on that note, I think we should, close this thing with some great works of this era. And, let's do our final notes, shall we?
Okay.
So it is my strong contention that great art is made not just in times of strife, but always and in every era. So now we're going to celebrate some masterpieces from happier times, namely last year, which, I don't know, there was a lot of strife last year. That was rough. But I've already named my favorite films and television shows of 2016. Listeners, if you haven't heard that already, please go ahead and check out our previous two episodes to hear my full list. But in the meantime, for today's final note, Jim's going to offer up his picks for the best films of 2016.
Well, I won't give you a lot of them, but I'll quickly run through them. Among recent films, I'm pretty crazy about La La Land.
Okay.
And like everybody else, I like Moonlight quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I like very much Kelly Reichardt's new film called Certain Women.
Yeah.
Then every year I used to write a piece for the Film Quarterly every year about my roundup of the 10 favorite movies of the year. And I always took the liberty of saying that the release times of movies are different. So I chose the right to say if there was a revival of a film I had never seen before and it was screened either for the first time or first time for me on the big screen, it was part of my experience in the past year. We'll talk about it. And I saw a couple of movies this year I would put on my list. One of them, very little known and I'm fond of. It's called Cash on Demand. Have you ever heard of this movie?
I'm not.
It's a Hammer movie. Hammer Studios, you know what they were. They were the sort of more or less B movie unit in Britain, who did a lot of the horror movies in the 1960s, the Hammer horror cycle. This is not a horror movie, but it's produced by Hammer. It stars Peter Cushing. It's based on he's great in this movie. It's based on a West End play. You know, what I mean by West End play, London West End play is like the Broadway theater or the. It's not by any means an avant-garde play. It's the well-made play. Yeah, I would describe it as a modern day Dickens story about a bank robbery. Anyway,
okay.
I think it's very charming.
And what was it called?
Cash on Demand.
Cash on Black Demand. Black
and white.
Okay.
Black and white, made in 1961.
Okay.
And then the other one, because the cinema here in Indiana has revivals of silent movies. This past year, they did a William S. Hart movie called The Return of Draw Egan, and it was a live musical accompaniment composed, a score composed by a student here in the music school, and that pretty well blew me away. William S. Hart is not realized as much as he should be as a great actor and a great movie director, and this is a cowboy movie. The Return of Draw Egan.
Return of Draw Egan.
Yes, and my son, who has now become a novelist, gave me a book. This he published his first novel this year.
Okay.
Anyway, he gave me a book for Christmas. I for a long time I've been meaning to read, but never been able to get involved with a now dead German writer named W.G. Sebald. And this is called The Rings of Saturn. It's an incredibly powerful and moving book, hard to describe, so I won't try to describe it right now. But I recommend that to anybody.
Rings of Saturn. All right, that's a lot of offerings. I love it.
Okay. By the way, the Rings of Saturn could never be made into a movie.
Why is that?
Anyway, go ahead. You'll have to read it.
Okay. My thing is, it's not a great movie, but it was helpful for me. I just watched Bright Lights, starring Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher.
I watched a little of it last night myself, and I thought it was fun.
Really like.
Oh, but by the way, the other nomination I would make, and maybe you did too, I don't know, is the ESPN documentary about O.J. Simpson.
Yes,
people are arguing about whether it should be nominated because it's a TV show, but and it's 8 hours long, I guess.
Right,
but that was
right.
the most powerful documentary I saw all year.
Right, O.J. Made in America.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That one, that made my number one TV offering.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't sure whether to put it in TV or movies.
Yeah,
but
it's hard to do that nowadays. Yeah.
Right, exactly. There's a fine line. But I completely agree. That knocked me out. Bright Lights, I don't think it's a great movie, but I really like spending time with Carrie Fisher.
That was quite interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just wish it was longer. I wish I could watch her do anything, basically.
But
in short, what I'm saying is I'm not over it. I'm still really sad. And I need more material, please. Can we get an extended cut? That'd be great. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. Listeners, what do you think of Touch of Evil? Come let us know on our website, FlixWise.com. Or you can like us and leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/FlixWise. If you want to join the Mercedes McCambridge fan club, you should probably follow me on Twitter. The handle is @FlixWise. But before you do all of that, please make sure you follow correct procedure. Go to iTunes, give us 5 stars, and tell Apple how much you appreciate everything we do. Come on, it's the right thing. It's the right move. On our next show should come the special Carol episode, which I've been teasing since the beginning of the year. And then after that, I think we have a FlixWise favorites entry. Listener Joshua Wilson is going to pitch Blake Edwards' Pink Panther sequel, A Shot in the Dark, for the FlixWise favorites list. But until then, Jim, it's been a pleasure having you on the show again.
Yeah, always nice to talk.
Yes.
Thank you.
And just a reminder, listeners, pick up a copy of Jim's book, The Magic World of Orson Welles, for more in-depth analysis of all of Welles' directorial work. All right. Until next time, adios.